wondered how many times you've crossed paths with an animal but haven't noticed them? They can seem so distant in our more urban areas, yet they're closer than you'd think. In cities alongside us, coyotes are all around. But the narrative surrounding this species is often so skewed. In this second of three episodes with Dr. Stan Garrett, professor of wildlife ecology at Ohio State University, we examine how coyotes have adapted to living in urban areas and have been able to survive off of small pockets of nature within these spaces. Stay tuned until the end of the episode for a very special discount code for Stan's newest book, Coyotes Among Us. Let's dive into episode two. Welcome to the Wild Foundation podcast short format series, Conservation Capsule. Imagine being able to quickly take a capsule, a pill, a dose of something that helps you retain crucial insight in the realm of nature conservation. Well, we've got just that for you. Through our Conservation Capsule series, we're handing you the effective dosage of words of wisdom from the environmental world's best and brightest. Let's dive in. Stan, welcome back to Voices of Wilderness. Thank you so much for being on this second episode with us. The first one was incredible, and I cannot wait to dive in to talk about more things related, because I was thinking coyotes. See, I was already too much in my head. Just related to coyotes. And let's dive in. Please go ahead and do a quick recap of who you are. And then let's start talking about coyotes and urban areas.
Right. Well, I'm Stan Garrett. I'm a professor of wildlife ecology at the Ohio State University. And I've had the privilege of being an investigator on a long-term project of coyotes in Chicago, as well as coyote projects in other parts of the country as well, and even Canada. But the Chicago one is the one that generates all the attention, and it is the one that we've been able to basically explore the most questions regarding coyotes, cities, people, and conservation.
Awesome. I love that you use the word investigator, because I think kind of that's a perfect way to sum it up, as you know, where we left off last time in our conversation of that first night that you tracked that coyote and kind of uncovering this world of the unknowns with them and really investigating what the heck is going on there and how they survive in these areas. So, I mean, I remember the story that you told, that you never thought that she'd be, you know, outside of this park. And of course there she was. So being, you know, again, from the Northeast outside of New York City, everybody's so used to seeing coyotes all over the place, but really I don't think people think past like, oh, that's just a coyote. How do they adapt to these areas and to these really urban areas? And I mean, just how have they done it? Because it's pretty amazing.
Right. That's basically the major objective of our long-term project. So just to, again, take a step back, we've been studying coyotes over in Chicago since 2000. We're just finishing our 23rd year, continuously monitoring these animals and trying to learn from them. So that's the basis. And so when you talk about the urban landscape, that's we've basically followed them into the city as they initially colonized the suburbs. Each year, it seemed like they were moving further and further into the city until finally they've made it all the way to Lakeshore Drive. And in this case, we're not talking about just animals that are exploring areas or the transients that are moving through temporarily. We're talking about animals setting up residence. And so the questions are, how in the world can they possibly do that? And so it's a combination of characteristics that they maintain, that they actually don't change as they move into the city, combined with other characteristics that they do change, and they're very flexible and plastic in terms of their behavior. So I'll talk about the things that we notice that changes. So as they move into those really, really urban sites, their home ranges, their territories shrink in size. So part of that has to do with resources. So they only have to cover as much area as they need to obtain food that they need. And so that's an indication that they're getting a lot of food, that there's a lot of food available for them. So territories tend to shrink in size, at least for a time, and they become also very nocturnal. So especially the animals that are actually living among us, that are actually, that they're not living in a really large natural preserve that's protected from us, but rather actually living in our neighborhoods or in our little parks or golf courses and sharing space with us, they shift their activity periods to become nocturnal. And that's a pretty dramatic change, because one of the things that you notice if you study coyotes for a while is that individual variation is really important. So you have individuals just like us that differ in terms of their lifestyle. So in terms of activity, also is very similar to us in that you could have some coyotes are early morning risers. Other coyotes tend to be active more at night. Other coyotes like to be active during the day. So when you plot this graph with all these different animals, and this is out in a natural area, you see activity patterns. I mean, a coyote can pop up at any time. But as they move into the city, now all of the coyotes are basically having to follow the same rules, which is to avoid us, they have to restrict their activities at night. So the individual variation disappears, and they tend to follow the same envelope in terms of activity.
How does that affect the whole, like the whole population? I mean, I don't know if we even have the answer for this, but removing that variation, how does that affect the health of that population that's pretty urban? Because I would imagine it has some sort of impact, right?
You would think. So I don't know how it's affecting the population. We won't know. That's a multi-year question.
Yeah, I figured. I figured.
It's a little easier to look at individuals than, you know, over a shorter period as opposed to the population, which will take a long time. We'll see. I mean, so this is a unplanned experiment. This is an experiment started by coyotes. They're the ones that moved into the cities. We didn't put them there. And we're waiting to see, like, what's the ultimate outcome of this? And so that's one of those questions, is like, when you force all of these individuals that normally would be showing that or expressing that variation, now having to follow the same rules, does that really impact them? Individually, I will say, so one of the things, the other adjustments that they make when they really move into the cities is that when they really get into the downtown core area, and this is the part where there basically is almost no natural habitats or any little nooks and crannies available at all, where we didn't think coyotes could ever live. They do live down there, and the way that they're able to move around is that they have to use the same routes that we use. So they use rail lines. They'll use major interstates or major travel lanes, like a large roads, you know, multi-lane roads that pre-travel routes for them. But they're also hunting and getting food along those ways. And what that does is it creates really linear movements. So the way that they move inside their territory is that their movement patterns all of a sudden now just basically follow our transportation arteries. So again, trains, rail lines. Some rail lines have been taken out and they've been replaced with maybe a bike trail or something that also forms a linear pathway for them. And so they're able to traverse these areas linearly. But what happens is that they have to travel farther to get to one place to another than they would out in the suburbs. And so when we coming back to that, the cost to those animals having to follow the same thing. One of the issues that we found with the nocturnal, like restricting their activities to nighttime, is that now they have to satisfy their requirements over a shorter time window.
Right.
If you're only going to be active at night and you don't have that flexibility, now all of a sudden you have to do it in a shorter period. So now they're having to travel these linear paths and only doing it at night. So we believe that that's probably coming at an energetic cost to them. And we do see slightly higher levels of stress levels in the urban animals, and it might be a reflection of that.
You bring up the, or you mentioned the idea of, you know, to find food for these urban coyotes. What does that look like? What is the food?
Right. So this is like one of the most important ecological questions for any animal, but especially coyotes. And it also, it's an important question with regard to their relationship to us as well. So how are they relating to us? Food is critical. And so it's really important that we measure that as best we can. So what we do, first of all, how do we measure food in their diet? It's actually kind of complicated in an urban setting. And so what we do is we take a whisker from each animal that we capture, and we're able to use a thing called stable isotopes, which is a chemical analysis of that whisker, and we section the whisker into little identical length fragments. So we can actually track, we can analyze each segment for certain diet items, and we can see how their diet changes or doesn't change over time. Over the
oh my gosh.
Right.
How cool is that? Wow.
Amazingly cool. So this stable isotopes is a technique now being used in a lot of ecology, not only like urban stuff that we're using it for, but I mean, even paleontologists are using it to, you can go back and look at fossils or bones or fragments, or like if you have hair from a mastodon or something, you can actually go back and look at the diet of that animal through their tissue. And so we use hair because it gives us a longer profile. So it's a great technique to identify things such as their major diet items, and especially using human food. So that's a little bit of background about how we do diet. The bottom line to that, the picture that's come out of that, so that we know, like we can look at each individual animal from that same whisker, that single whisker, and look at that profile. And what we find is that there's incredible variation among the individuals. So I just mentioned earlier that individual variation is kind of a characteristic of coyotes. Diet is something that's also highly individualistic. So they're just like us. We all have different diets for the most part. And so it turns out that coyotes are reflecting that same kind of individual variation, even as they go out to the city. So in this respect, they're not having to follow the same pathway, even as they go into the city. We thought they would have to. So we thought the only way those animals can live in that kind of highly urban environment is they have to eat our food. They've got to be eating trash. And some are. Some are, that's definitely one pathway. And so there are some that have the same diet that you and I have. So they're eating hamburgers, they're eating French fries, or eating other things. But there's a lot of them that are not. A lot of them are eating even natural prey, even finding that prey even in the city. And then there's a whole bunch of them that are mixing and matching. So some of them, they're taking a few human food items, but they're also still hunting and doing the things that coyotes are supposed to be doing. And in fact, it's the majority of them that are still primarily finding more natural food or the typical food of a coyote and not human food. So that's what we're finding down there. So basically, they're all over the place. It's a really cool image. We can plan you, I guess, you graph all of the individuals in their diet, and you put them on this, what we call an isotopic plane. So it moves them around depending on where they're located relative to their food. Basically, they're all over the place. And that's actually one of the primary keys to their success, not only in a city, but everywhere, is that they don't follow the same dietary pathways. They're highly flexible in that area. So that's one aspect of their the ecology that's highly plastic and continues to be highly flexible even as they move into the city.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me all around, but that they would be so resourceful in finding food that way, because it seems like an almost impossible task in such urban areas. But then add on that their digestional, that their GI tract, all of that can handle food that is so foreign to them is amazing. I definitely could ask you a million more questions about these animals and how they function, but I do want to make sure that we get to kind of the capsule portion of this particular episode on coyotes and what you'd really want people to take away from this portion? I know next time we're going to be talking about how people adapt to having these animals in their urban areas, which I think will be an incredibly fascinating conversation. But what is that nugget of information that you really want us to leave with?
Yeah, there's a number of points I could point out.
Please do.
Well, I mean, the thing I want to leave you with is that, you know, these animals are teaching us. So when we radio collar an animal, we're trying to learn their story. We're just sitting back trying to take notes. Okay, what do you have to teach us? The capsule that I want to leave you with is something that they've taught me, which is, so again, it's you know, kind of dispelling some of the preconceived notions that we may have about what is habitat to an animal, what is food to an animal, or how does an animal exploit that environment. And so in this case, you could point to a number of different ones. One is that, again, be careful about your preconceived notions. We thought that they would have to be eating human food. And once again, it proved us wrong. I can tell you, like, there's a coyote number 748 raised a litter right across the street from Soldier Field in Chicago, right on Lakeshore Drive. That's as urban as you can get. He had a diet completely composed of rabbits, at least during the lifespan of his whisker, which is about 4 months or so. So that he's a great example of an animal that, so who knew that rabbits were that common, but it is true. In fact, we followed him and we watched him catch rabbits along Lakeshore
Drive. That's amazing.
So that's an example of being careful about preconceived notions about what animals require. And the other issue we kind of talked about, I didn't think about this until you picked this out, which is the individual variation. And this is becoming a really important issue in behavioral ecology. And that is that we're beginning to see, we've been trained as scientists to create these averages or means that we characterize all populations in terms of, you know, one number, that this is the average. But it could be that the key to a success of an animal or a system may be the variety as opposed to the mean. And I do believe that that's an important characteristic of coyotes and probably many other animals as well.
Wow. Thank you so much. Like I said before we started the conversation, this is the best way to start my day. I love having this information and I cannot wait for us to share this with the wild audience because it's truly just so fascinating and the work that you do is incredible. I am beyond excited for our next conversation. So I hope that everybody tunes in for that one too. So thank you so much, Stan. Have a wonderful day and we will be catching up with you very soon.
All right. Thank you.
Want to learn more about Stan's work? Use the code VOICES20 on IndiePubs for 20% off Stan's new book, Coyotes Among Us. You can also use the discount link provided in the episode description wherever you're listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to today's episode. Find us on social media through the Wild Foundation or through our website, wild.org. And hey, if you're feeling inspired, don't hesitate to share this podcast with those around you. And maybe even rate us on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts. We appreciate the support more than you know, and it's that support that allows our work to continue and evolve.